Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past 4 following news, Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis talk with Spartans Head Football Coach Mark D'Antonio.
I think I was hired here to try and make people happy. So I'm trying. Okay, but I'm trying. We'll just keep trying to move in that direction, and again, I'm just humbled to be here.
Then they talk with the world's leading water scientist, MSU's Joan Rose. Then Simon and Hollis talk with plant scientist, Brad Day.
We're everywhere. You get off an airplane in India wearing an MSU logo, you're a celebrity. It's the coolest thing in the world.
It's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR, and we get started at 4:06. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Welcome, I'm Russ White. Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Spartans Head Football Coach Mark D'Antonio. Here's A.D. Hollis.
Well, we're just coming off the spring game, and this is the summertime, so this is an opportunity for you to look back at what happened throughout the spring as we prepare already for fall camp. And I know your staff's busy at work, but kind of give us a reflection about what you saw in the spring and where you see the program heading going into August.
Well, first of all, I think we've got a football team that expects to win. And so they're motivated by that aspect. Obviously we graduated some very good players, and they've gone on to the draft, and they've gone on to their respective teams. So we'll miss those guys, but that's the cycle of college athletics. I think we have a very good young team. They've got a basis, junior-led team sort of, got some seniors that are very strong as well, but I think it's more of a junior-led team in respect that when you group the juniors and seniors together, it's pretty strong. We've got a lot of guys who've played a lot of football here, and the expectations are high. There's certain position groups that are very, I think, deep, but I think we tackle well on the perimeter on the defensive side of the ball. We've got some big play wide receivers, got three very good backs. I think our quarterback situation can be solid, and I think we didn't lose a coach again this year, so I think what we've tried to do is critique what we've done and try to improvise and get a little bit better. So we're going to find out what that's all about as we get into August, but feel good about our football team. Right now I think we're 22-2 or 23-2 maybe. I'm in the Big Ten Conference in the last 3 years. So, we've got a chance.
Notre Dame is back on our schedule for the next 2 years. Talk a little bit about that being back in.
I think that's a rivalry game. And, you read back the history of Michigan State. They were largely responsible for us getting in the Big Ten. So, a great opponent. They play a very tough schedule. I think the game will be at Notre Dame this year. It should be a nationally televised game. And I think what you see now happening in college football, you see Ohio State playing Oklahoma, and you see, LSU playing Wisconsin. There are big games on the docket for Big Ten teams. Mm-hmm. And you multiply that with 9 conference games, and you've got a strong schedule for every football team that's in the Big Ten. If they're going to go anywhere, do anything with it, they're going to have to play somebody real. And, Notre Dame's a real opponent.
When you turn your eyes back to Spartan Stadium, we have an opportunity. We'll host once again a Friday night game, which leads into Labor Day weekend, part of the opportunity to let folks celebrate, closing down the cottages and enjoy that Labor Day weekend. But we also have BYU, Ohio State, Michigan, several other really good home games. And that's, you look at that from the advantage of winning games, but you also look at the advantage that has in propelling recruiting for football, recruiting for all mm-hmm. sports, opportunities on campus for various colleges to have large celebrations. So it's really a home schedule that really plays a positive in so many different aspects.
It really is. We play Wisconsin here as well, and so all those games are going to be packed. Wisconsin travels, so does Ohio State, so obviously does Michigan. Somehow they creep in there. But, so it's a great, attractive home schedule, and our guys are going to be excited to play. And we're tough. We're especially tough in Spartan Stadium. And, we get our students are very much involved. We had 500 students come out to practice last week. We've had them, mm-hmm. or a couple weeks ago, I guess, and then also, run out for the spring game. So that was an exciting event as mm-hmm. well. So So we have a lot of people back in the Spartans, and right now it's a feel-good story, so we got to keep it that way.
You know, it is a very tough schedule, and you talk about winning. You know, and football coaches, you know, have to be sort of a triple threat in terms of, you know, obviously the games issue, but also this academic performance and the capacity to develop people. And, you know, obviously over the last period of time, we've been really good at all three of those things. And this is a really, from my perspective, this nine-game Big Ten season makes it really tough. I think we're playing with BYU and Notre Dame, probably one of
the tougher
schedules out there.
Top five.
In terms of adding that to the mix. And, you know, young teams are young teams. And so I just enjoy the fact that we're a program, and we're a program to be contended with no matter who's on the list of the Big Ten or nationally. And if you think about when you came and where we are now, you know, independent of what the exact number is going to be next year, you know, we're a program to be contended with. We'll be a program to be contended with the next year and the next year and the next year, because we've built the depth. You've recruited kids of quality, not perfectly, because you can't recruit 18-year-olds or 16-year-olds with perfect sight. But by and large, the proportions are really good. And that's really the part that I think for university is so critical, to have the right people, the right values, and always build towards a sustainable program. And this is really, you know, I know there are some coaches who don't like me saying this, and some people, but, you know, you'd have to look a long time to find Michigan State in this position. And there are very few places around the country that are actually in this kind of program definition moment. And you've helped get us there, and we thank you for that. And it's going to be fun to watch these young kids, you know, particularly some of those wide receivers.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I really think that coaching is teaching. Truly, if you get into coaching, you need to get in for the right reasons, you know. And you know, right now you're the head coach of Michigan State. I understand all the things that go along with that financially and everything else, responsibility-wise and all that. But coaching is teaching, and as long as you maintain that approach, empower your players, and help them overachieve and provide growth for them as people, you hope that that's what defines you ultimately. But I keep telling our players, you know, anticipate the difficult by managing the easy. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've done here. We've managed the easy. You know, as easy, it's difficult, but if I stand up there and say we all have to go in one direction on the first day I got this job, we can be champions.
And you had
that's an easy statement.
And you had your Ohio State ring on to prove it.
Yeah. That's the only ring I had at that time.
Yep.
But that's easy to say that. That's easy to say that. Yeah. Much more difficult to do. But if we just move together, and you two have been really instrumental in our success, I really mean that, because there have been tough times, but every time that there's been a tough time, you know, you guys have provided the support in all sincerity, and you know, that's how you get to the top. It's great to see our players' dreams come true. It's great to see our dreams come true, all of ours. I remember, Mark, you talking about our feet, our cleats being in the middle of the Rose Bowl. So that's what you do. That's what you're trying to do, you know. And I've said it before, you know, I think I was hired here to try and make people happy. So I'm trying. Doesn't mean I golf great. Okay, but I'm trying. So we'll just keep trying to move in that direction. And, again, I'm just humbled to be here.
Well, you have made people happy, and keep yourself happy too.
Right.
Go green.
Take care.
Thanks, guys. Good luck.
Bad snap. Bobble.
Oh!
Scooped
oh!
up. Here come the Spartans. Down the sideline. Racing into the end zone.
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
Racing into the end zone is Jalen.
Oh,
Watts. Jackson. Touchdown, MSU.
Touchdown.
Folks, no flags. The
no flags.
Oh, my God. Piling on each other in the end zone. It's over. The Spartans win again.
Oh, my God.
The Spartans win again.
That was Spartans head football coach Mark D'Antonio talking with his bosses
Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon. To hear an extended version of the conversation, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. Now, President Simon and A.D. Hollis welcome the world's leading water scientist to the program, MSU's Joan Rose. Here's President Simon.
It's really our pleasure to welcome Joan Rose. Joan is a water scientist, but has the recent recipient of the Stockholm Water Prize, which is the highest sort of Nobel Prize for water. But Joan, your career has involved marine biology, working with Singapore on really thinking about them as a water nation. And you also do a lot of practical work in Flint and other places. So when you think about the biggest challenge facing water in the world, what would you say?
Water quality, me, is the biggest problem, and it's so complex. And when my parents used to say, well, what is it you do as a scientist again? I'd say, well, I follow the feces around, you know. And you really, this whole idea, I mean, if you think about what has happened globally over since the 1950s, this acceleration of people, acceleration of animals, because to feed the people, that all produce waste. And those fecal wastes carry a multitude of organisms. And we now know that we're seeing more organisms jump from animals into humans. We're starting to talk about the One Health. We're connecting that to the One Water issue. And, you know, with quantity, we have such a good idea in quantity of what it means. You know, you've got a glass of water. Yeah, you've got a swimming pool full of water. We've got maps, global maps of water. But when you talk about water quality, that means something different to different people. Which constituents, emerging contaminants, how do we measure them? Does it affect me? Does it affect my kid? You know, does it affect the animals? Does it affect our plants? So water quality and its link to the biohealth of the planet, I think, is our biggest challenge that we're going to be facing, and it's going to take us several decades to really get our arms around it.
Are you surprised about Flint?
Anytime there's a disaster in the water business, I call it the plane crashes for the water business. And we actually have about anywhere from 5 to 10 plane crashes a year throughout the United States for different reasons in a community where their whole water system is affected, where people get sick, where people die. Flint I am always shocked when we have a plane crash in the water business. And I guess, you know, just like any disaster, we have got to learn as much as we can from it to try to prevent the next one and try to help others who are on the edge of teetering over into the same kind of problems that the people of Flint have experienced.
Does the planet have a natural process to cleanse water? This may be a strange question, but through natural processes, through evaporation, are there known ways that the planet cleanses its own water?
Well, you know, when you think about the water cycle that you learned when you were in elementary school, and then you learned
it
in high school,
though,
right?
So refresh me.
The rain comes down, it flows around, you know. The thing that's been left out of the water cycle in the 21st century is the human piece of it. We're now in a human-coupled system. I don't think there's any part of the water cycle that is not touched by humans now. So if we think about the natural process, certainly evaporation cleanses the water. Mm-hmm. Even rain cleanses the air and brings things down. The rain falls, goes through the soil towards groundwater. It filters. Lakes and reservoirs have natural systems for settling things out. As rivers bubble over rocks, they're aerating. Mm-hmm. So all of these natural processes we can replicate. We can replicate them with engineered systems. We can improve them so that they're faster. But we've challenged the waters of the world with more contaminants than it ever saw before. And some of these are very recalcitrant. They're not easy to get rid of. Mm-hmm. And so we need to think about how we merge the natural systems and the engineered systems and relook at this coupled human water cycle and really start to think of it at the global level, this one water idea. Ultimately, the future is about this transformation that can take place with the I think the interface between how we manage water, the technology, and the quality and quantity we want to achieve for a sustainable community, sustainable globe. And that means that, you know, especially in the wastewater side, this transformation from wastewater treatment to resource recovery, energy, water, nutrients. That is going to be one of the futures, I think, that will help sustain water systems in the, you know, throughout the world.
What, the Flint issue reflects sort of the need for infrastructure or the concern about infrastructure, as well as chemicals in water. But in the United States, in the world, it may be the diseases that are going to be part of the water that we don't fully understand that may be the next big local or world health crisis. Because of microbes, other kinds of things, pathogens that we don't really understand. We at least understand iron and lead.
We
understand that. We may not have gotten it right, but it's a knowable proposition. But these other things that are entering into the water because of the way we live and what we do are potentially bigger threats. How do you think about looking at and defining water quality around those kinds of critters, to use an elegant term?
You know, cholera and typhoid were the poster child, you know, or the poster children, I guess, of waterborne disease. We had a lot of typhoid in the U.S., especially in the Great Lakes. Cholera is still widespread. And in some ways, we kind of know, okay, we know how to take care of that. But every year, there's an emerging pathogen. And they have a link to water. Even Zika virus, right? That's a water-based disease, which means that it's connected to water through the mosquito and through humans. So we've got water-based disease, waterborne diseases, and every year something new shows up. And we really lack an understanding, especially in our drinking water distribution systems, what's going on in these biofilms. And wherever there's water and whenever there's a pipe, there's a biofilm, and that's microbial. And this, we still have Legionnaires outbreaks throughout the U.S. It's the number one cause of waterborne disease in the United States. And this naturally grows in pipes, in water systems. And yet we don't know very much about monitoring it, how it blooms, how to control it. We have not dealt with it adequately within the Safe Drinking Water Act. And we continue to have these outbreaks. We had one in the Bronx, and then we've had these two serious outbreaks in Flint. These microbes are very adept at living in these niches. And humans get exposed, and then they get these diseases that we're not quite sure of on how to control them.
So there's two approaches I'd like to ask. One is, how do you take care of yourself, and how do you take care of the world? As you're talking to listeners on this and hopefully beyond, you know, myself in a house, how do I make sure that I'm safe? And then what do I do to make sure the world's safe as part of a collective population?
Well, I think that this whole idea of reaching out to the community, the ability for us to do engaged research is really going to help the individual. I mean, if you think about do people even know where their water comes from when they turn on their tap? And do they?
Top.
Yeah, exactly. Or right. where it goes when they flush their toilet right. or run it down the sink. The rural community actually knows because right. they have their own well and they have their own septic tank. And in some cases, through county health and through extension, we've done a pretty good job saying, do you have pesticides? Do you have nitrates? What's the quality of that water? That water feeds both their families and it feeds their animals.
Right.
They look at the septic tanks. In these peri-urban areas, we haven't done such a good job on septic tanks that we should have. We have too many of them. And so we are able to pinpoint those locations now and start to work with the individual. But, you know, I think so. Education is one. Individuals, and sometimes in the rural community, we know better than in the city community, in the urban community. We need to reach out to the people that work in the city, the kids, and get them reconnected to water. Everybody is connected to water in some way. They love water. You know, they've got their favorite beach. They love to swim. You know, and many understand, of course, I have to drink water and cook with water, but it can be a spiritual connection. And so when you start talking to individuals, they really do care about their water. And so we have to get that knowledge back out. I think the water business has not done a good job in communication of water engineering and science. And I think it's going to be up to the academic world to do a better job. And once you have knowledge, you're going to make better decisions about funding, the bonds that come up and the investments that need to be made. But I do think that this also we can be an individual voice at the national and state level. So, you talked about aging infrastructure. And you see different numbers, but it's in the trillions. It's in the trillions of dollars over the next 20 years that we have to spend on our water infrastructure, whether it's stormwater, wastewater, drinking water. So I sat down and I just calculated the total population of the U.S., how much would it cost per person, per day, to pay for that if we paid for it by ourselves. And it's $80 per woman, man, and child per day for 20 years. So $80 for 20 years per person per day. We can't afford that. We have to have the state look at ways that they're going to help fund infrastructure. And we have to look at the way the federal government is going to fund this. And it's not going to be the old way. We've got to use new technologies to do it. For fixing our pipes. There's new things that, balloons and, cameras and things like that that can go into the water system. I was intrigued by, the news where they were going to send out all these probes into space, these tiny little probes to explore outer space. We need to do the same thing in all these pipes, these little probes that go out and tell us where to fix what pipe, when, and where,
Right.
Yeah, we have to do it smartly now. We have to have smart water systems. We have to think about the cities of the future. I think that we'll get there if we are smart about it.
Thank you, Joan, for your leadership. Congratulations again on the Stockholm Prize. It's absolutely spectacular.
Thank you so much. I'm very honored.
And great for us, but it's just one of those things that is a rare award for anyone, and it's probably as difficult to get as the Nobel Prize. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Welcome. I'm Russ White. That was MSU's internationally renowned water scientist Joan Rose talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear an extended version of the conversation, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. President Simon and A.D. Hallis now welcome plant scientist Brad Day to MSU Today. Here's President Simon.
Brad Day is an associate professor and department chair for research in MSU's Department of Plant, Soils, and Microbial Sciences. And one of the things that Michigan State is really good at is plant sciences, from things that happen on the ground, production, agriculture, all through the most sophisticated genetics, genomics work in the laboratory. And this challenge of trying to feed the projected population in an environmentally and economically sustainable way, it has to be both in order for us to really solve this problem, is something that will require great ingenuity and imagination, much like when Michigan State was founded 60 years ago, and plant science was still being able to graph two things together, like the art museum exhibit, and have something that would be producing more corn, more soybeans. So, Brad, it's really great to have you here. Tell people what it's like in your lab. What's your lab look like? We can't have everybody go over there and sort of tour through, but what would they see if they were going over to your lab? What would it look like?
Right. So, we're fortunate, we're blessed here to have really state-of-the-art facilities, but I think what's interesting is really what I've seen is the evolution of what science is just in the past 10, 15 years since I was, a postdoc or a graduate student, and it's a mixture of people. It's a mixture of people working at the bench, doing the experiments on plants. It's a mixture of computer scientists. I work with biosystems engineers, nanoscientists. So it's a think tank. We're all sitting around throwing spitballs at problems with each different perspective. And at Michigan State, it's really a cool way to do that. It's popular. It's possible. It's possible.
So as you sit around and talk, and you develop solutions or recommendations, tell me where in the world, and I mean that literally, where on the globe do those solutions reach to?
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
It's unbelievable. I've had the opportunity to travel for Michigan State, really, to Africa, to South Asia, to India. We're everywhere. You walk off, you get off an airplane in India wearing an MSU logo, you're a celebrity. It's the coolest thing in the world. And we have collaborators. We have heads of state. Our alumni are all over the place, so we're working everywhere.
So you leave the think tank and you go out, boots on the ground in a location.
Right.
Give me an example of an interesting experience that you would have had or encountered.
I can think of two that were, really brought back the responsibility of being a plant science professor at MSU, one of the top, if not the top, places in the world to do what I do. The first day was 2008. I was a wide-eyed assistant professor, and I had an opportunity to travel with the Gates Foundation to Kenya to visit a number of subsistence farms and look at their problems and see what the problems facing Africa is. They're very different than what we see here in Michigan. We really have it good. And so we had traveled to the state-of-the-art research facility that the Gates Foundation had built and a lot of other universities around the world and around the U.S. had built. And we walk into this lobby, and it's much like the building that my lab is in. It's a really beautiful building with marble and stainless steel. And all of my colleagues, there's about 15 colleagues from the U.S. from various different universities, and we're all looking around, and they're all finding their university's names on these little 2x5 placards, and they're all posing for pictures in front of these. And I'm looking around, and I can't find MSU. And one of my friends goes like that. And it's about 10 times the size of the Ohio State, the Florida. And it was amazing. It was like, holy cow, What have I gotten myself into because of the responsibility? But meeting with growers, I don't work in the field that much. My research is really at that cusp of discovery and translation. So going out into the field is remarkable to see how food is grown, to see where our food comes from, and to really see the challenges that people around the world have in getting good, healthy food is another experience that sticks with you.
I think that to bring it back to sort of the Michigan experience, because people sometimes think that we're not really tending to Michigan or U.S. needs. The idea that things change, that if you look even, regardless of what you believe in about the cause of variability in climate, there's a long history, a long piece that we know that at one point in time we were part of the Ice Age.
Yeah.
And we know that there's just going to be this large scale climate variability. And what part of what you do, which will affect Michigan and Michigan farmers, is how do we think about the way plants exist, grow, their characteristics? What can we do to them to make them more tolerant, more hardy,
right,
in terms of some of these temperature variations,
right,
that can even occur now as you think about cherry trees, other things, mm-hmm, that are crops that are potentially damaged, mm-hmm, now because of weather variability,
right,
natural,
right,
weather variability. And that's a really complicated problem.
It is. I mean, there's so many variables. And a report was just released last week, I believe, maybe just a few days ago, that March of this year was the warmest month in the history since 1880, since they've been recording it. The temperatures rose 2 degrees. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a domino effect. 2 degrees here globally. It was 115 degrees in parts of Africa, 10 degrees warmer than it had ever been. In Michigan, I think we have a real responsibility to protect what we have. We have over 200 crops grown in Michigan. We have 20% of the world's fresh water touching Michigan. So my job, where I feel I can make a, you know, make a dent in the problem, is protecting what we have and understanding how do we preserve in the face of climate change, in the face of pathogens moving around the world. Pathogens and infected plants move around the world almost as freely as we do, and they don't need a passport or a visa to do it. So that's a big problem. So I think we have a great responsibility to protect the resources that we have in Michigan. And as part of that, understanding how to protect that and then disseminating that knowledge through kind of the World Grant mission that President Simon has so proudly, you know, waved the flag for. I think that's my biggest challenge for the next 10, 15 years and where I want to leave my mark.
So I grew up in the Thumb of Michigan, mm-hmm, where I think traditional agriculture, mm-hmm, resides. Big plots of land,
right,
soybeans, sugar,
cucumbers,
sugar beets.
Yeah.
Then you think about what you do in applying food to locations.
Mm-hmm.
I have to ask an odd question.
Yeah.
Did you see The Martian?
Yes, I did.
Your thought on their application for Matt Damon growing food on Mars, and was it a realistic approach?
It actually is, and there was an article, I believe, in Science Magazine just this week or last week that there is a project now by NASA to do just this. You know, they're going to have to grow them in atmospherically controlled conditions, but they are starting to do a lot of these growths. They're working in the desert. And so that, I think that's one of the important things that we need to start thinking about, is not only how do we grow the right crop in the right location, how do we grow all crops in any location?
Mm-hmm.
Again, we're spoiled here. We can grow over 200 crops, but in some parts of the world, they're subsistence farming. They can grow corn, soybean, and that's about it. And so that's kind of one of the things that we're working on in my lab, is how do we bring food to all corners of the world?
It was the robotic mechanism that,
yeah,
President Simon was referring to that led me to that.
Yeah.
I then look at, you know, people live in large concentrations,
mm-hmm,
in the United States. Detroit is surrounded by a lot of agricultural,
yeah,
area. There are some communities or some countries,
right,
where they're landlocked, and there's huge masses of people.
Right.
Some of that requires import, but I'm assuming some of what you do is finding ways, brainstorming on ideas to deliver crops,
yeah,
to be grown in those environments.
Well, the coolest thing that I think we're starting to see, you know, whispers right now around campus is, how do we start bringing agriculture to very urban areas, reclaim land? And I was just in D.C. Last week and visited with Senator Stabenow's office and the Ag Subcommittee, and they were very interested in how you can reclaim land in Detroit to begin growing crops. And with that comes, I think, another great opportunity is, how do you engage people in urban areas and children, for example, to become interested in agriculture? I mean, we get a lot of our fantastic plant science students grew up on farms. I mean, it's hard to swing a stick in Michigan without hitting someone,
yeah,
that didn't grow up on a farm. But, man, imagine if we could get somebody from Manhattan or Tokyo or Hong Kong or Detroit that says, I've never been on a farm, but I want to be involved in agriculture. And I like to repeat the quote by Wendell Berry, if you eat, you're involved in agriculture.
Right.
And if we can spread the word.
But I want to sort of get to a hot button issue. If we look at the evolution of plants dating back to good old Beale and the,
mm-hmm,
work that people did with the plants that were still digging up in the garden, they were the plants were hybridized using grafting, mixing seeds, lots of work that really produced a different plant, but it wasn't introducing a different species into the mix. It was just a different plant through the process of mixing and taking nature's variations of plants. Mm-hmm. And now we've gotten much more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up in Indiana, we put little bags over the top of corn to catch some and not others, and try to do that in a way called hybrid corn. So now we're into a debate as more of these modern molecular techniques are being used. Mm-hmm. How much are they different from the old days? They're just faster and more precise.
Yeah, they're just faster and more precise. They allow us to go in and ask very specific directed questions and not have to, you know, we can predict very accurately what we think will happen. And then we still need to do all the tests that the traditional breeders were doing, you know, when they were mixing to, you know, pollen from different plants and looking for the hybrid vigor. We can do that very quickly now. We still need plant breeders and geneticists to go out in the field and look and see how these things perform. The debate, I think, is, you know, we've again been fortunate in the United States is that as we've communicated as scientists, I think, to the general public at a level that at least people are willing to listen. In Europe, it's a much very different situation. No GMOs. We don't want it. We don't want any DNA in our food. And that's a little, you know, it's a little short-sighted, I think, because we're in an awesome period of time where we can take advantage and just speed up the process. I mean, we've got, 34 years until 2050, 9 billion people on this planet. How are we going to feed that many people with the same amount of land? You know, the statistics say we need to double the amount of food we're making every year just to catch up and just to meet the demand. So we need to use technology to catch up to meet the demand.
But again, the it's not as if you're introduced. It's not like the cloning story where you're mixing two things together and you take a sort of a soybean and a ear of corn and you make something new. It really is keeping within the character of the plant.
Absolutely, yeah. So the new technologies now that you're referring to is called CRISPR. And there was just several releases just in the last week. You may have seen it in the news. A group at Penn State University had modified mushrooms, right? So they no longer brown. They just went in and snipped out a little piece of the DNA that caused the mushrooms to brown. So now you've got a longer shelf life. That's an amazing advance because we lose probably 20% of our world's food supply to just spoilage. I mean, the easiest way to think about it is a therapy, mm-hmm. all right? I mean, it could be potentially be righting a wrong. You know, you may have had a mutation in the BRCA gene that they just go in and snip it and fix it and say, this is what you should have had all along. We're just going to go fix it. People have been breeding plants for millennia, and who's to say that they were doing it right the whole time? But they were doing it right for the environmental conditions that they had. The climate 200 years ago was very different than it was now. So they were making crosses between plants and selecting plants based on the climate, the temperatures at that time. Mm-hmm. We can't go back. We have no time machines, as far as I know. We can't go back and undo or redo what they've done. But with these new technologies, we can go in and discover what they've done using ancient species. We do this a lot in my research group. We go back, we've got problems with cucumber diseases. We'll go back to wild species that were first identified in India hundreds of years ago, and we can say, okay, this guy's resistant to the pathogen. Why? What did we do to this wild cucumber to make it so susceptible now?
So. Well, actually, you know, you have to give, if you think about the genius of Beale back when Michigan State was founded, he planted all of those, he left all those seeds behind mm-hmm. for us to be able to have a benchmark mm-hmm. about what the world might do with some of our basic plants.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And because he was very visionary in the sense he knew that no one of these mutations would ever turn out to be perfect.
Right.
Because they're very much random in the world. And what pollen gets over what plant and mm-hmm. what two plants you put together or what people thought would work. And so it's really, I think, a very exciting way of taking that old history and putting it into the modern era. And you're very much a part of the forefront of that, and we're so excited to have you a part of our team.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for your work.
You're
welcome.
Thank you.
That was MSU plant scientist Brad Day talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear an extended version of the conversation, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Bob Scandalaris is a 1974 graduate of the MSU Broad College of Business. He's founded and served as CEO of several private and public companies and established Quantum Ventures of Michigan.
Quantum Ventures is a company that invests in companies around the United States, primarily right now in distribution and financial services and manufacturing. And we have historically also been involved in some high-tech startups, but right now we're not doing that. So it's just a boring company that spends a lot of its time looking at boring old industries where we can try to change things. We look at companies that, for whatever reason, aren't doing as well as they could do. And these are not turnarounds. They're not disasters, but they're companies where, you know, typically an 80-year-old or 70-year-old has run the company. And it's a lifestyle company for him towards the end of his career. His sons are not willing to take it over. And when we get that, there's a lot of changes culturally that have to be made that would make the company stronger and better. So you know, there's a real opportunity there to enhance the lives of the employees and create some wealth for people in the company.
Scandalaris is passionate about entrepreneurship.
Besides being an entrepreneur, you know, I look at the country, and if you go back to when I graduated, you know, we all wanted to work at IBM and Chrysler and GM and those kinds of companies, and they educated us for those jobs. And over the last probably 25 years, a lot of those jobs have been outsourced overseas, and it's a global world we're in. And so if you look where the jobs have been created, they've been in startups, they've been in technology companies, they've been places where we can compete not necessarily with $2 an hour, you know, wages that are in some places overseas, but where we can use the knowledge that's created by U.S. universities and benefit the world. And so the companies like Oracle and Microsoft and Apple, they didn't exist when I graduated, and that's who's been creating jobs. So I just think if we're going to make the U.S. a better place for our children and our grandchildren, we're going to have to find ways to enhance entrepreneurship in this country.
I asked Bob whether entrepreneurship is a skill one's born with, or can that skill set be learned and honed?
Well, there's a lot of debate about that. I think that the skills that you would use as an entrepreneur certainly can be trained, and universities are a good place to do that. And but whether or not you're a risk taker or an entrepreneur or want to be, you know, sort of this self-motivated person willing to take on the challenge of being an entrepreneur, I do believe some of that is you're born with it and it's a part of your DNA. 75% of entrepreneurs come from families where one or both parents were entrepreneurs. So there has to be some leanings that go that way, but it is not. I don't think you can take somebody that doesn't like taking risk and wants the stability of a job and make them comfortable as an entrepreneur.
Entrepreneurship skills go hand in hand with President Simon's T-shaped professional initiative.
One of the big words out there is entrepreneurship right now, and big companies are becoming more entrepreneurial so they can compete, because in the technology world, everything changes. It changes fast, and people respond to competitive changes quickly. So you have to be a little bit entrepreneurial, even if you work in big companies. And I think that you know, the skills that you can learn as an entrepreneur, even if you're not one, are really valuable as you go forward in your business career.
With this in mind, Bob's advice for today's young people is all about passion.
Well, for me, it's all about passion. So I still believe you have to find your passion. You have to find the place where you belong. And if you do that, you're going to enjoy what you do, and you're going to be better at what you do, and you're going to be willing to invest the time and energy that it takes to really hone your skills. So, you know, to me, it's just find that place where you have comfort and find – the environment where you can really take those skills and talents and hone them. And if you do that, life will be good.
Scandalaris and his family give generously to MSU.
Well, there aren't too many places where you can give some money back to a cause and see the direct impact it has on the people that you most want to help. So you can give to cancer research, and certainly that's a worthy cause. But when we feel like when we give to Michigan State, we can see the benefit it brings to the university and to the environment. And, you know, universities need the support of people out there, whether it's, you know, $100 or $10 million. It doesn't matter. Support, and they need that support.
Spartans win! Touchdown, MSU!
You know, I met Bob Scandalaris on the day that I was introduced as the head football coach at Michigan State.
That's Spartans head football coach Mark D'Antonio. Many know of Bob Scandalaris as his name is on the headquarters building for Spartan football.
On that day, he walked in and said, I know you have this, I know you have that, but what do you need? What else do you need? What else can I do? And since that time, he has been extremely supportive in every aspect.
There's no question Bob Scandalaris has put his mark on Michigan State.
Coach Izzo concurs with Coach D.
He's been a great guy. He's been a guy that texts you when you're down. He calls you. He's been a guy that's here for you. And he's here financially, but he's here in body, too. You know, he's at our events. He's at our games. He's on the road.
Bob Scandalaris is co-chairing MSU's Empower Extraordinary Capital campaign with Dee Cook.
There are two women in my life that inspire me. One's my wife and the other's Dee Cook. So, you know, I think that, you know, the university needs money, obviously, for scholarships. You know, there's a lot of talk about the gap between the rich and the poor. Education should not fall into that gap. Education should just be if you're talented enough and desirous of going to a top university, we should make it available to you. So we have to figure out how to do that. Professors, we need to keep the best professors at Michigan State. So if that means we have to support their research, that's important. Facilities, you know, they get old. And as they get old, they need to be replaced. And the technology changes that have taken place, a lot of the older buildings have to be updated. So there are a myriad of reasons why you would give, and where you would give depends on where your passion is. But if we're going to take MSU and 100 years from now look back and say, what a great university, we're going to have the support of a lot of people. And we've got 500,000 alumni, and you know, they love Michigan State. So it's just a matter of getting that group to really start throwing in support. And they are. This campaign's been very successful to date. So we're very proud of what the university's been able to do.
Learn more at empower.msu.edu.
It's a knowledge-based economy going forward, and the place that trains the minds are our universities. The places that do the research that are really changing the world are the universities. And the universities are getting pinched, they're getting squeezed, especially the public universities, where the money coming in from the state is diminishing. 10 years ago, we got 70% roughly from the state of Michigan to cover tuition. Today, it's about 17%. So that gap has got to be covered, and costs are certainly not going down. So it takes the support of you know, a whole village to support someplace like a Michigan State, and they are really, really important to the future of this country.
There's more at givingto.msu.edu.
I'd like you to think about the difference you're going to make, because the dollars you're giving today in some cases will help the university today, but most of them will help the university for years and years to come. And that's hard to do.
I believe this job is about people, and I think he believes the same.
Bob Scandalaris has been as special a guy as I've known since I've been at Michigan State University.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association with another observation from the Spartan life. Here's one of my favorite nuggets of wisdom. Every medium has a point of view. Challenge it. Brian Kay, a Twitter friend, sent me the following tweet this week. MSU Scott W., how do I know I can believe what you're saying? My answer? Ask around. If you hear differently,
tell me. In the coming weeks, the political campaign season will be kicking in. We will again be inundated by half-truths, scary sound bites, and unsubstantiated charges, all designed to generate fear, uncertainty, and doubt about some candidate's opponent. Hundreds of millions of dollars will be spent to try and convince us not to vote for someone else. By the same token, we are daily bombarded with messages designed to get us to do something, buy something, like something, hate something. The more shocking the images, the more lurid the charges, the better. When you find a little voice inside your head saying, "Wow, I can't believe what I just saw," listen to it. Challenge everything, but be willing to do your homework. The world is complicated. The issues we face don't have easy solutions. If they did, we would have already figured them out. We all bring our own prejudices and self-interest to the table, too. Preconceived notions about how things should be can easily dominate our own thinking. Do your homework. Special interests, and that's not necessarily a bad term, we all have special interests, spend time and effort to try to convince us that their interests are in our best interest. That may or may not be true. You get to decide whether or not it is. But try to understand all points of view before judging. That often takes work. The truth isn't always clearly visible. You have to peel off layers of hyperbole, obfuscation, and misinformation to find it. The people who create commercial messages and political attack ads count on the fact that most of us won't bother to fact check. Their biggest fear is that we will. The same goes for whatever positions you take, decisions you make, actions you take. They will be challenged. And that's a good thing. Questions and criticism can help us clarify our own thought processes. In some cases, this may modify our point of view. In the best case, it will force us to do our own homework to ensure that our actions are in line with our values. If they aren't, have the courage to go through the sometimes painful process of changing them. Your homework may reinforce your confidence in staying the course, or it may inspire you to explore a new direction. The worst thing we can do is to do nothing. Be an informed voter, consumer, leader, team member, and friend. Challenge everything, especially your own paradigms. Do your homework. You won't make everyone around you happy all the time, but you will make better decisions and most likely enjoy more productive outcomes. So, Brian, don't take anything I say at face value. Challenge it and do your homework.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear the show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.